Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
So we scampered up the north side of the valley and finally, you know.
But that's 1,000 feet though. I mean, how did you get the 1,000 feet? Was that all, did you have any, you know, rappelling gear or whatever? Was that all just done by foot and trails and?
Foot and trails. I mean, it was definitely pretty vertical, but not so vertical that you couldn't climb in and out.
But going down 1,000 feet is a hell of a lot easier with all your gear than going up 1,000 feet.
Well, you know, when I had, you know, the ground force commander fire into the radio, get your ass out of that valley. You're stopping us from calling in air support.
That was motivation.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
But when I got out the other side, I realized that I had screwed up because guys were like, what in the fuck were you thinking? The ground floor, you know, my boss, the XO, came up and just ripped into me. And instead of humbling once again and just saying, wow, you're right, I made a bad call. I didn't. I fought against it. I was like, you know, hey, I made the right call. I ran to the sound of the guns. I went to support guys. And I think they were so this was the perfect storm. So tactical errors, drinking, me butting heads with my platoon chief repeatedly. And now this bag haul became the storm. And my XO was like, sending you back to the rear to meet the commanding officer. So I got to fly back to from down south in Kandahar back to Bagram to meet with our leadership and the commanding officer of the team. And really a rock bottom moment for me.
Tell us about that. What's going through your head? When did it finally hit you that... Oh, geez, I fucked it this time.
Probably in the meeting where I met with the commanding officer, and the troop had flown back at this point. So I got back, and there were a couple of days before the troop finished that mission and flew back. And I sat in a meeting with the commanding officer, our command mash chief, senior leaders of our team, including my chief and my OIC, the ground force commander. And they basically were all saying, hey, you know, you're dangerous. You know, guys don't want to work with you. And that's a really big blow in our community. I mean, that's the biggest blow you can have. I mean, you don't measure up, that you're dangerous, that guys don't want to work with you.
So you're Maverick to the Iceman then.
I was.
Speaking of Top Gun,
but,
yeah.
You know, I went back to my room. They told me they'd let me know their decision the next morning. And I went back to my room and I put a gun in my mouth and I almost killed myself that night. I was so...
What stopped you?
My wife and kids, the picture of my kids on the desk in front of me. And I think the big guy above, you know, what are you doing? What are you doing?
Absolutely.
Like, what kind of message do you leave for them? And thankfully, I hadn't quit anything at that point in my life. And I was like, you know, if you do this, you're quitting. This is the ultimate form. So I went and found, and I frequently speak on this. I speak to law enforcement, fire, and military. I went and sought out help. And it's amazing to me in our community how I did the right thing. I went and got help. But so many of us try and deal with things by ourselves, which is the exact opposite when we're suffering from mental health problems. You know, we don't clear rooms. So, you know, first thing police do when they're in an issue is they call for backup. You know, fire don't, you know, clear buildings by themselves. Yet when we're struggling mentally, we try and do it on our own. And I was, you know, going down that same road. So,
you know, Murph and I have talked about this many times, and probably, I don't know, your experience is a little different because military being in theater, but I've lost more friends in law enforcement to suicide than I did line of duty.
Yeah.
And I can think back to the, and it's like, you know, actually, one of the guys when I was a trooper, one of the guys out of my class went to a federal agency years later, almost did it in a hotel room. I mean, had a shotgun, pulled away at the last second, lost part of his eye. And I just think about all the people I knew that, And to your point, you go, what? And we've talked with several guys, Lou Velozzi being one of them. You know, we talked about how close Lou was. We've talked to other guys that were half an ounce away. You know, they got to 1-2 and almost to 3. And I said, what stopped you between 2 and 3? You know, and that was not Nate, but that was
Kevin Holtry.
Kevin Holtry.
Out in Boise.
Boise, yeah. I mean,
it is Kevin Holtry.
Kevin Holtry and Brian Holland was the other one. When we were interviewing, he was in so much pain. We had to stop. I mean, just to watch him, he's double amputee now, paraplegic. The bullets hit his spine and everything. He's lost both of his legs. And Murph and I were talking, one of the hardest interviews we ever did because of, you watched how much pain he was in. I mean, it almost put me in tears. And this guy was a half an ounce away from taking it all. But here's a guy in a wheelchair waking up every 90 minutes at a minimum, even if when he's sleeping, because he can't take the pain. And yet this guy's still here. And I'm going, man, if you can do it, you know, I got no excuse.
But you know what? And I think you've got the same thing here, Jason. The sense of humor, it kind of goes along with being humble, learning how to be humble, and self-deprecating humor gets me through a lot, especially when you're in front of an audience speaking, because there's nothing special about us. It's just that we were able, you know, I couldn't do what you did, and you probably could do what I did, but I'm going to say you couldn't. But the same thing with Kevin. When he said, you know, we were talking about how big a man he was. I said, well, you're like 6'4". He said, no, I'm not. I'm 3'8". I don't have any fucking legs, you know? And I'm thinking, you got to have a sense of humor to say stuff like that in that kind of condition.
Humor plays a big part. Although sometimes, man, when you're in, you know, man, I was at rock bottom, to find humor in those situations. But that you got to depend on other people to help you. And that's what I talk about now. And that's where you do have to, we tie ourselves so tightly to this identity, whether it's the seal or the badge or fire helmet, or, I mean, even in life, we all tie ourselves to whatever title we have. And that moment kind of became a little bit of a launch point. It still took some time before I really kind of grew up and humbled myself and came to grips with, you know, a title and this badge, this pin you wear, medals, whatever they are, none of that shit makes you anything. You know, the individual does, and how they carry themselves and how they lead. And that became a new journey. And that's where everything kind of changed. Everything I speak on now is built around that journey from getting myself in trouble. You know, they didn't end up taking my trident. Thankfully, my commanding officer believed in me and gave me a second chance, but it came with some growth opportunities.
Yeah, that's a euphemism.
Yeah, in the beginning, I just saw it as punishment. You know, they took away any awards I was supposed to receive from that deployment. I had to sign an unofficial letter of reprimand that if it had gone into my officer record, would have ended my career. It went into the safe of the CO, and he said, hey, you do a great job. After 2 years, this gets shredded. And then they sent me to Ranger school. That's how I ended up going to Ranger school.
Mm-hmm. That was punishment, going to Ranger school?
It was.
Yeah. Why? Yeah. No, seriously, I'm joking. Was that punishment, or was that designed to
growth opportunity.
Growth opportunity. Mm-hmm. And what was the growth opportunity you were supposed to learn from going to Ranger school?
To humble myself, you know, and if anybody that out there has been through Ranger school, the great thing about Ranger school is, you know, there are guys in Ranger school who have been in for 10, 15 years. You have O5s that go through Ranger school, you have SFGAF guys, and none of that matters. You don't wear any of that stuff when you go through Ranger school. Everybody's the same. And
it's like airborne and stuff too. Nobody cares who you are. You either make it or you don't.
Ranger school is a leadership school. That's what a lot of people don't realize. At the end of the day, everyone has a spot as a leader, and you will, sometimes you're a follower, sometimes you're a leader, and it does what you've done or what your past is. And I'll tell you what, it was very smart of my commanding officer to send me there. I really needed it. And, it humbled me and changed, my mindset for the future. And it really became the base of a lot of the stuff that I speak on. I call it the three rules of leadership: lead yourself, lead always. I teach balance, Pentagon and peak performance, the five key areas where leaders should be balanced. All these things really started to grow out of Ranger school. And as I move forward in my career from there.
Rangers lead the way. There's a reason why. But let's go back. I want to go back to that morning when they brought you back in. In your heart of hearts, what did you think was going to happen to you when they brought you back in?
You know, I wasn't sure. The chaplain gave me some pretty good advice, and it's something that I talk to in talks, that so often when we have these rock bottom moments in our lives, we convince ourselves it's the end. But if you're willing to follow that path, there is a new beginning. You know, it may be the end of one part of your life, but the new beginning. So he said to me, you know, no matter what happens, if they take your trident or if they don't take your trident, you know, tomorrow's a new beginning. It's up to you for what you're going to do with it. And it was really great advice. So I didn't know what to expect going into that meeting. And I'd love to tell you there was a sigh of relief. And there was a little bit, but I also was bitter. I was bitter. I was angry still. And it took into Rainbow before I finally...
Who were you angry at?
Myself. I felt like I was a victim. I still believe that I had made the right call. I still had failed to take a look at... I was blaming everybody else, which is a common problem when we get ourselves in trouble. You know, I blame my chief. I blame guys, you know, I did what was right. I ran to the sound of the guns. You know, look at me. I'm heroic. And you guys are just throwing me under the bus. And all of that was bullshit. All of those were lies. You know, and it was finally when I got to Ranger School that I came to grips and was like, hey, man, you know who's to blame for you being here? This guy. You are. You're the one that all these things led up.
Now, in relation to, we want to start getting into September 13th, 2007. But before we get into that, in relation to that date, which is obviously kind of one of the reasons we're here, you're come to Jesus, you're going to Ranger School. When did that happen in relation to 2007?
It was almost two years.
All right. So you had some time to get things squared away, get your head squared away. When you came out of Ranger School, you said you had this realization. How did that change you as a leader?
A lot more humble, a lot. And it, you know, I didn't come back to the SEAL teams after Ranger School, and guys were super excited to have me. You know, in our community, your reputation precedes yourself. And my new nickname was Rambo Low Red. Guys didn't want Rambo Red in their platoon. That's not a compliment. You know, a lot of people may think that's cool out there, but Rambo was an individual. Special operations is absolutely dependent on being an effective member of a team. So I had to earn back the trust and respect of the guys that I was supposed to lead. And thankfully, I had an amazing boss and mentor who gave me a lot of opportunities. He said, I don't care what happened in Afghanistan. He said, you know, I'm gonna call on you to lead. And when I call on you to lead, I need you to lead. And other times, I need you to follow. But he said, you know, you just focus on you. And that became lead yourself, lead others, lead always, no matter what's happening. I just showed up and slowly tried to win back, you know, the trust and respect of the guys. And over time, it happened. I mean, over about a year, you know, by the time we finally got slotted to deploy to Iraq, Iraq was a super volatile place in 06, 07. And only the top ranked platoons were the ones that were getting sent to Iraq just because they knew you were going into the shit. Our troop got selected for that, and it was the best troops I've ever been a part of. So definitely kind of the finishing for me as a, you know, an officer kind of rebuilding myself, figuring out how to lead in the combat theater and very chaotic, you know, combat environment. You know, we were conducting operations almost every night by the time we got back.
Yeah, it's funny you were talking about, not funny, but you know, you're talking about Fallujah, Iraq. I mean, there are many places that were such hot spots, or if there was going to be action, it was going to be those places. So let's start setting the stage now for September 13th, 2007, Fallujah, Iraq. What was going on at that time? Where were you guys stationed at? So kind of give us the groundwork that lays up to you being in Fallujah just in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I think in 2007, definitely in 06, 07, Afghanistan had slowed down quite a bit. The SEAL teams actually pulled out of Afghanistan in the at the end of 05, which is when I left Afghanistan, into 06. I'm not sure when we went back. It might have been 07, 08. But things were definitely ramping up in Iraq. I mean, Iraq was devolving into chaos. You know, on multiple fronts, you had obviously in center Iraq around Baghdad, you had this heavy Iranian influence. So, I mean, really, we're almost fighting a proxy war with Iran. through Muqtada al-Sadr and the Shia, the Shia individuals that were there. In Western Iraq, in the Anbar province, you had obviously al-Qaeda and the insurgency that was occurring around Iraq. The heaviest fighting probably happening out there in Anbar, which, of course, your major hotspots would be Fallujah, Abaniya, and Ramadi. So,
hey, Jay, real quick question. You said the SEALs pulled out. Was that just the SEALs? Was that other special operators? Is that because things had slowed down, or did they have a strategic change in direction? Why the break?
McRaven pulled us out because there was a lot of political pressure, and I write about this in my book, The Trident. Things had slowed down. There was tremendous political pressure that was occurring from the senior leadership, the ambassador, the Afghan government, about the way we conducted special operations. And they did not want us doing nighttime fast roping, breaching. They wanted us to, they were implementing something called soft knock operations. They wanted us to, A, alert village elders 24 hours in advance that we were coming to take down the target, and B, go knock on the door. These were things that were actually happening. So I can't speak for the other special forces, but McRaven, at the end of that deployment in October, and I'm not sure exactly when it occurred, shortly thereafter of 05, he said, "I'm pulling my SEALs out. You're taking away all their strategic tactical advantage. I'm not putting them in danger, for this." So there was, at a minimum, a year, maybe a little bit longer, that we were out of Afghanistan and just focused in Iraq.
I didn't know that. I mean, Steve, that's the equivalent. That's the equivalent of telling a target, "Hey, we're going to serve a search warrant on you tomorrow. Don't destroy anything. Don't set up an ambush. But hey, we got a warrant. We're going to come out and knock on your door and say surprise tomorrow morning at 6.
Except you're going into an environment where you know in Iraq they're going to have weapons. You know, a drug trafficker typically does, but if he may not use them, whereas where you guys are, hell, they're going to use them.
Oh man, it was a big fear. You let someone know ahead of time. I mean, you know, we often talked about a crew served weapon at the end of a hallway, and yeah, you come knock on the door and they just mow everybody down. So thankfully, McRaven, I personally am a fan of Bill McRaven. He was the one star totally in charge of all SEALs at that time. And I thought it was a great call, and, you know, supported it. I mean, I was a young leader back then, but obviously for us, it didn't change. I mean, we weren't slotted to go to Afghanistan after that. I rolled into my next platoon. This is about the time I got myself in trouble. I think we talked about all that. So I had bigger things to worry about, like saving my career and growing up. Trying to stay in the SEAL team. So that was really my focus. Typically what happens in any SEAL team, I can't speak for the rest of special operations, but within the SEAL teams, at some point, usually the beginning of the year, a deployment order is issued and they say, these are the hot spots in the world. This is where we're going to send guys. And then obviously there's contingency operations that spring up where guys get sent. In this case, what happens is whoever is in the pipeline, whoever is on that deployment cycle, it is up to the leadership to decide who's going to go where. And obviously, wherever the hottest spots are, typically it's going to be your best troops. If the CO has issues or concerns, he's not going to send his top guys. He's not going to send his worst guys or guys he has concerns with. He's going to send his best guys. So typically the decision on where you're going doesn't occur until only a few months prior to deployment, and then you'll be notified. And that's what happened with us. We found out, one of our troops was going to Baghdad and we were heading out to the Anbar province. Both, I would say, were equally as dangerous. I mean, what was happening, our city was just imploding. And obviously, 06 and 07 in the Anbar province was some of the toughest fighting. I mean, if you read Jocko's book and they talk about the fighting that they encountered, Chris Kyle, that was in the summer and fall of 06, moving into 07. And that's when we arrived, and we got there. In April of 07, the very first deployment we did, or I'm sorry, the very first mission, I wasn't there yet. I hadn't arrived. We had sent our first wave of guys. They had linked up with our other SEAL team, and we did frequently when we're doing what we call turnover operations. You have the outgoing team and the incoming team, and we blend guys so that, you know, you guys know the deal. So, hey, you've been in country for 6 months. I'm going to shadow you on this mission. So now you can share your information and say, hey, this is what's dangerous and stuff like that. So on the very first mission, they went into Karma, Iraq, going after a high-level Al-Qaeda leader and got into a fierce, fierce firefight. This is the firefight that Senior Chief Mike Day was shot 27 times, and they thought he was dead. Petty Officer Clark Swedler was killed. We have a couple of other guys that were wounded. One of the Iraqis was killed, and the firefight was so intense and that the platoon pulled back to the next house because they couldn't even make entry from the amount of fire. And nobody was saying anything. They thought everybody was dead. And Senior Chief Mike Day came to from unconsciousness and killed three of the terrorists on his own before he managed to get up after being fragged and shot 27 times and cleared the rest of the house and called the guys and said, hey, come get me. They're all dead. Unfortunately, we lost Mike this year to suicide. He took his life in March. Man. He was awarded the Navy Cross. I personally think it should probably
should have been the Medal of Honor.
But Mike was a tremendous warrior and someone who really fought the demons of war when he came home. But that was the very first mission on our deployment with my troop. I showed up a little bit after that. And it was basically like that for most of that deployment. We were hitting targets in Fallujah, throughout Anbar, and frequently going back into Karma. And got into multiple firefights, had guys wounded. In June, we took down a very complicated target that we had 11 women and children on in the middle of this gunfight that we ended up having to pull inside. We had enemy barricaded on the roof with a machine gun and dropping grenades down on us. And we ended up having to navigate all this and move these women and children plus our wounded to another house where we called in an airstrike. On that house and eliminated those guys. On that same deployment in July in Baghdad, those guys were hit in Sadr City, our sister troop, and we lost three guys. One of our guys that was severely wounded ended up losing his leg from that. And this was an Iranian EFP. So, you know, these insidious devices that were designed to punch through our armor.
That's what I wanted you to talk about. There's IEDs, improvised explosive device, but the Iranians, the Quds Force, the IRGC, these guys started coming over with these EFPs, explosively formed penetrators. Tell everybody how much more insidious those things are as compared to IEDs.
Yeah, so an IED is just a big explosion, although IEDs, depending on the vehicle we were using, we had not gotten the MRAPs at this point. The MRAPs were the larger special operation designed, mainly blast-proof vehicles. I don't want to say they were specifically designed to try and thwart some of the effects of IEDs. We were still running in the armored Humvees, so they were a little more susceptible. So a really big IED could take this thing out. If you had a 2,000, 5,000-pound IED, I mean, it could definitely do a lot of damage. You still could survive because we were armored. The Iranians developed something called the EFP, an electric
explosively formed penetrator.
Thank you. Explosively formed penetrator. That
and
was
who specific. Knew? I've never been a SEAL and I knew this shit. I mean, how does this shit happen?
Well, thank he's a you. Nerd. It's
too many acronyms.
He's a nerd.
But
he's
what
a nerd.
It was designed to do is it created this molten copper slug that would punch right through our armor. And when it went through our armor, it created this vacuum inside the vehicle that would fill it with fire and do devastating damage inside and obviously punch right through the vehicle. I know guys, Sergeant First Class Mike Slitz is a friend of mine. He was a Ranger. He was the vehicle commander in a vehicle that took an EFP that went right through the driver. Mike was working on the computer and the projectile went through both forearms, killed everyone in the vehicle. Mike, miraculously, it hit the door. The door popped open and he fell out of the vehicle on fire. It's the only thing that saved his life, but it burned over 90% of his body. He is an amazing, and he lost both hands. Although if any of you are looking for inspiration, he is an amazing guy. He works for the Gary Sinise Foundation now. But these things were insidious. And it's so, you know, I was so glad, you know, I'm not I'm not always the biggest fan of Trump. I don't always like the way he leads, but I tell you what, when he killed the Iranian, Soleimani, man, that was spot on. That guy had so much American blood on his hands, and everybody was so upset and up in arms. And I was like, you have no idea the amount of American.
Yeah, but what the hell was he doing in Iraq? He was in Iraq. What the hell is an Iranian head of intelligence doing in Iraq?
I'm probably following up what they started way back in 2005, you know, 2006, whenever they started, you know, fighting their proxy war. So that was the battlefront. That was the battleground, the environment that we were fighting in. And definitely very complicated. Although on the flip side, it was everything that you ever dreamed of doing as a SEAL. For me, after I got myself in trouble, I was able to put a lot of the leadership lessons into play, and learn, you know, at the end of the day, you know, in the special operations community and the law enforcement community, you know, back in garrison, that doesn't matter. All that matters is how do you lead and how do you operate in combat? I had screwed that up in Afghanistan. So to be able to figure that out and to have done a good job and to be running with such an amazing troop of individuals in Iraq was, pretty amazing. And we did a lot of great work. You know, we estimate that I think we captured over 120 mid-level and senior Al-Qaeda insurgent. And we aided a whole bunch of others on their way, the ones that obviously didn't want to get captured.
Allahu Akbar, brother.
Well, you mentioned Admiral McRaven earlier. That was that shows you what a leader is there, that he's got the stones to stand up and pull his people out when they start putting ridiculous restrictions on you that make it so you cannot successfully do your job and bring our people home. You know, the politicians making those damn rules or the idiots that are making those rules probably have never been out in a war zone, probably never had a bullet fired at them and have no clue what they're putting you guys into. So hats off to Bill McRaven for standing up and doing the right thing there.
And, you know, Jay, that's the other thing. Real quick, talk about that, too. It follows onto that. All these ROEs, these rules of engagement. I mean, one of the things I heard from people is that it was so crazy. There were different ROEs depending on where you were. And it was like that kind of got not only with those things that you're talking about McRaven was pushing back against, but multiple ROEs. It's like, how did you know what you were supposed to do at any given point?
Well, and they would change. I mean, I talk about in my book one night where the ROE and our signaling with other forces had changed, and I screwed it up. I should have caught it, and I didn't. I missed it, and could have potentially created a blue-on-blue incident when we came up against a Marine patrol on a night, you know, nighttime mission that occurred in Fallujah. So some of it, you got to have leadership that's really savvy. You got to be aware. Some of it is, thankfully, when we were in Iraq, I thought the rules of engagement were pretty good in our favor. You know, if we saw someone that we deemed a threat, you know, we were able to engage them. I mean, the enemy knew our tactics. They knew our rules of engagement. So frequently they would shoot at you, drop a gun, and then calmly walk someplace else because, you know, they would know that, hey, if we don't have a weapon. So, you know, you had to get really good at hey, that's the same guy. And, you know, and thankfully, I think that most of our guys in special operations, I mean, we obviously want to kill bad people. You know, and for anybody out there that offends you, I hate to tell you, there are evil people in this world. There's no amount of education or hugging them that's going to change their hatred and violent ways. And those people, and usually, thankfully, those people were the ones who fought back the most. I write this in my book that there were probably three groups of people we encountered in Iraq. The larger group were opportunists. In a war zone, the economy has collapsed. So normal jobs, you know, the normal day-to-day economy kind of has gone away. A lot of people have lost their jobs because there's an active war happening. So what would happen is Al-Qaeda or the insurgency would come around and say, hey, I'm going to give you $50 to go put this IED at the end of the road. And many of them did it because they needed the money. They weren't sympathetic to the cause, but they needed to feed their family. So when we would roll up on somebody like that, I mean, they were crying and whining, and I love George Bush. I love America. I'm really sorry. And obviously we would wrap them up, and they would have to, we would collect the evidence and turn it over to the Iraqis, and it was up to the Iraqis to decide what to do with them. The second class were sympathizers, and those guys usually put up a fight, but they weren't usually willing to fight to the death. Most of those guys we ended up capturing. The third group were the diehards, the zealots. That was about the 10%, and they fought to the death every time.
Well, and room temperature is a good look for some of those guys. But you just mentioned something we wanted to tie into. We talked about this in one of our pre-calls, and you talked about turning evidence over to the Iraqis. You guys also had to now become kind of conversant in some law enforcement tactics, sensitive site exploitation. And I know I'm thinking about like the bin Laden raid. You know, you raid that. You've only got a limited amount of time, but you've got to exploit that site, you know, hard drives, whatever it is. You know, there's a lot of things you got to do. So tell us, too, about as we're getting into this, what's some of the training you got on sensitive site exploitation, and, you know, what did that entail? Because at some point, if you want to really, quote, try these people or put them on trial, you've got to do some things by the rules.
Yeah, absolutely. And so most operations were kind of two-part. You would have the initial assault portion, which was a little more dynamic, a little more kinetic. But once the target was secure, then it transitioned to more of a police action. And that's where the sensitive site exploitation started. So we would secure the target. Sometimes we may have additional, what we would call enablers, people to help us, whether they had, you know, some kind of specialty that we could bring in, and maybe they were, you know, whatever it was, they would come in after the target was secure. And then we would start that, gathering whatever evidence. I mean, if there were explosives, we would collect that. If there were weapons, we would take, if anybody was killed, we would obviously take pictures of what happened and where it came from. And, you know, why, you know, we had to kill that individual. And all of that was cataloged and turned over. And we did training both within the military and we actually trained with law enforcement that, you know, we learned about a lot of these things working with them, because it really did. It became more of a law enforcement function once the target was secure. And, you know, if you capture, we don't want to, you get information out of live people. So obviously we want to capture people as much as we can. And from there, with evidence, we now are able to either prosecute or use that evidence against them to hopefully, you know, at the end of the day, we want more information. We want to get to the top people. And and by having that evidence and stacked against them, that enabled us to gather more information.
Which law enforcement agency trained you guys?
I think I'm going to leave that out for now. So, I mean,
it wasn't the FBI, was it?
No.
Okay. Okay. We're good. I just want to know, because then you guys would have transitioned to suits.
Yeah, no. We work with some different, you know, major law enforcement, municipal, you know, big municipal people who are dealing with a lot of crime.
It's all our Bureau brothers. We still love you.
Yeah, I still love you. But what the hell? It's no secret, too, that a lot of guys that ended up going down to Guantanamo to assist, some of those guys came from New York, LA, you know, people who investigated lots of crimes. And you were talking about that, too, you know, just even getting some of the training or dealing with people. But even though you guys were collecting a lot of people, how many percentage-wise, how many people ended up going with the CIA?
You know, I'm not really sure I remember those numbers.
But I mean, without giving anything away, but there were certain people that had an interest beyond just standard law enforcement. There were some people that were of interest somewhere in another food chain, right?
I'm sure they were.
You're being so tactful here.
Yeah, here you go, Morgan.
Dude, I just want a trip to Guantanamo. By the way, that's Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is still down there.
Where he should be.
And I still haven't brought him to trial after 22 years.
Where it's fine.
No, good buddy of mine is trying to push that across the finish line. So
let's hope they get it done, KSM. Well, let's go back to that now. So you guys, like I said, there was two functions. You got your assault function. Then if the opportunity presented itself, you got the exploitation function. So now we've kind of set the groundwork. Let's start talking about you now. Let's start talking about this mission that obviously changed your life.
Yeah, we were at the end of the deployment. We were actually gearing up for the turnover from the next deal team. They were on their way there, and we had it had been a very active deployment. We had done, I believe, 80 direct action capture kill missions, which is a lot, and a very successful. But also, we had had a lot of close calls. We had had, you know, we had had several guys wounded. You know, we had, thankfully, our troop had not lost anybody directly, but obviously our sister troop had lost guys in Baghdad. We had had a lot of close calls. We had close calls with just missed IEDs. We entered a house that was rigged with explosives, and thank God whoever was on the other end of the command wire was not paying attention. Or it did not work because we were all in the house that could have been detonated and killed all of us.
Jay, on those IEDs like that, when you say the command wire, were some of these like hardwired in, or were some of these also cellular?
No, this one was hardwired. Yeah, and we found it as we were searching the target. There were some signs that something was amiss. Our EOD guy quickly recognized it, immediately found the hard wire running out the back of the house, and thankfully it did not go off. We ended up falling back and dropped 2 500-pounders on that house, and there were a lot of secondary explosions. So,
jeez,
man.
So yeah, we had had one of these close calls, and we were kind of wrapping up. We had packed everything up, and we had decided, hey, we're just gonna hold the last couple of missions we had on the books till to do his turnover operations. But on the just about 1 week or a couple of days prior to those guys coming in, we got word that the senior leader for Al Qaeda in the Anbar province was going to be in a specific place in Karma, specific place and time, what became a time sensitive target. And I didn't think that mission was going to go. There was a lot of things about that mission, some that are probably still classified, that made me think this mission was not going to happen. So it was probably about 4 o'clock, I think, when we did, you know, typically we slept vampire hours. So we would get up, and the very first thing to do, leadership would have our 4 p.m. morning meeting. And that's where we would talk about any potential missions or anything like that. And that's what was percolating. So I went and, you know, got dinner or breakfast, and then, went and worked out. And, I was in the gym when one of the guys was like, hey man, this mission's going. So we jocked up, we got ready, and because of the timing on the mission, we ended up landing, what we call directly on the X, directly on the target, which is not our preferred method, but, we had to for this. We landed, my team leader and I, it was kind of interesting that the helicopter actually landed backwards. Originally we were supposed to land where the opposite side of the helo was our breacher and point man and recce guys, but the helo came in, and it was me and my team leader and probably our communicator that were sitting in the door with the stack of guys behind us. So we quickly, my team leader immediately recognized it, and he was out the door. You know, I don't even think the helo had touched down yet. He was out the door running towards that front door, which obviously when you're coming in on a helo, time is of the essence. So I was behind him. The door was open. We ended up crashing it, made entry, and nothing happened. I mean, I don't think I've ever expected to get all shot up as much as I did on that target. That target was only a couple hundred yards away from where we got into the really big firefight in June, where we had guys wounded and the women and children. It was probably only another few hundred yards away from where Mike Day and Petty Officer Clark Schwedler was killed. So it was definitely a very hot spot in that area. And we made entry, and nothing happened. We searched the building. We found a lot of activity and started finding explosives and weapons buried in some of the outer buildings and the walls, but no people. We had missed a guy, and that's just the nature of the beast. You guys know that as well as I do. So we thought it was going to be a quiet night. You know, at this point, it's about, I don't know, 2 a.m., 3 a.m. The plan was we were going to blow all the explosives in place. And then we were going to extract, and that was going to be the night. But while we were sitting there, the sniper started noticing a lot of activity on another house about 150 yards away. And they were just watching all this. And then they watched five individuals kind of run out the front door, run across the street and hide in some vegetation. So my boss came up to me and said, "Hey man, this is what we saw, you know, and we had seen this before. The enemy's not always aware that we can see all that we can see the way we do business." And said, "Hey, these guys ran, they're hiding. Obviously they're hiding for a reason. Let's go walk down, let's wrap them up, and let's find out who they are and what they know." So so he said, "Hey, take your team and let's do this." So we did.
How big's your team?
So we left with nine. So it was eight. It was seven SEALs, my UOD guy, and an interpreter. We like I said, it was about 150 yards north of us. And we started pushing through some pretty dense vegetation, and I won't get into the tactical details, but we were doing things according to what we had done prior, what we had seen and how we had trained. We, at this point, had pushed a AC-130 gunship up above, and we were asking, "Do you see anything? Do you see any weapons?" And they were like, "No, we don't see anything, you know, just individuals laying there." So we started pushing through, man, super thick vegetation. It reminded me of like a bamboo grove. That's how thick it was, which totally negated your night vision goggles. You couldn't see anything other than a green blur. So my heart's pounding in my chest. You know, and at one point I was like, "Man, is this the right decision?" I was like, "Man, that's just fear. Squash it. You know, we're doing this according to plan. Keep pushing forward." At one point the gunship said, "Hey, you're going to miss these guys. You need to turn to the northeast." So we did. But what happened is we weren't aware. My three guys on the left flank, you know, we listen to different frequencies. We have the gunship frequency. We have our inner freak as a leadership freak. They were not listening on that gunship freak. We had all been on that. And for whatever reason, they didn't hear that call. So when we made that turn, they kept going straight. So now we realize this pretty quickly, but in that dense vegetation, you know, four or five steps, and now you're talking about you're a good 10, 15 yards away from each other in the dark, super dense vegetation with an unknown enemy force on the ground, technically in between us. So we quickly realized this was a really dangerous potential blue-on-blue situation. Guys on my right flank said, "Hey, man, I'm close to the edge of the field." Guys on the left flank said, "Hey, we're close to the left side." I said, "Okay, let's both push out. Let's move up to the north on the open end of the field, and then we'll push back down on the enemy." And we coordinated this with the gunship.
So you were able to reestablish communications with the guys on your left flank then?
We were. We were able to talk to them on the radio, identifying, you know, we all agreed, "Hey, we're separated, too dangerous to do this in the vegetation." So they pushed out, we pushed out. Now there's three, so there's six of us on the right flank, five SEALs and our interpreter. And as we are stepping out at this point, I've come out of the vegetation and I'm kind of up front at this point with our interpreter, with one of our other guys behind me. And I'm starting to move, back towards the west, which is where our other guys were, so I could get eyes on them. But right as we started moving, we were maneuvering now, my last guy was coming out of the vegetation and he literally stepped on an enemy fighter. And the enemy fighter tried to roll over and engage him and he shot him, and that triggered the ambush. So what we didn't know was those five guys were the last part of the security detail for this leader that we were after. We estimate there were 12 to 15 fighters. They had two PKM machine guns in that vegetation and 12 to 15 fighters. So their ambush line was set up, forward, you know, to the north. And so we had come up behind it. And then unfortunately, because of the way we broke off, we walked right into it.
So how did they avoid detection? Were they covered up with something to avoid heat detection, heat signatures, or is it just because of how dense everything was?
You know, I'll let you guys decide what you think about that.
Yeah, I mean, I know that's why I didn't know if that was part of their tactics, if they'd gotten to the point where they'd figured out how to do countermeasures, you know, with FLIR or things like that. I mean, some things have been reported open source, so I don't want to get into anything that's classified, but I didn't know if these guys were adapting their tactics as well.
The enemy's smart. We always say the enemy gets a vote, and on a regular basis, we kill off the dumb ones.
There's a saying. If you're going to be if you're going to be stupid, you got to be tough.
Yeah, yeah. So for whatever reason, yeah, we could not see whether they had weapons or not, or the full extent of their line. But we definitely felt it once we walked into it. I mean, the machine gun opened up. Our medic was initially hit. He took a round right below the knee. I was a little further down and out front, and I started engaging. I'll be honest, my first thought was cease fire, and is actually what I was yelling out at first, because I knew from the angles we were at, you know, we're over on this northeast corner. I didn't know where guys that had gotten separated on the west were, and all I'm thinking about is we're shooting back towards them. But I wasn't entirely sure we're shooting at them.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
I quickly realized that's ridiculous because, yeah, I could definitely tell that this wasn't an M4 when that PKM opened up, both PKMs.
Are PKMs 7.62 or what caliber?
Yeah, it's 7.62 by 54. So it's the larger.
It's a nasty round.
It is a big bullet. It's the Russian or Chinese equivalent of the M60. So they had two PKMs that now were opening up on us. Our medic was down. One of our other guys ran forward and grabbed our medic and started dragging him back. The only thing behind us to the north was thousands of yards of empty Iraqi desert. And there happened to be a large, like John Deere style tractor tire and one big tree that wasn't far from that. And the guys fell back to that. My interpreter made it over to the tire. One of our guys fell behind the tree and the rest of the guys fell behind the tree. I was still out front trying to lay down fire when I got stitched for the first time by that machine gun. So across my body armor, I took two rounds in the left elbow, which I thought shot my arm off in the moment. And then...
Did the armor do its job? Did it stop those ones that you took?
I assume. I never got my plate back. So I yes. I mean, I didn't suffer any injury here. I took at least eight rounds is what we know. I took rounds off my helmet. I had my left night vision tube shot off. I took a round off my gun. I took a round off my right side plate, two rounds in the elbow. Recognizing this is a really bad place to be, I tried to move back to the tire at this point, and that's when I caught a round in the face. It hit me from behind, caught me right in front of the ear, traveled through my nose, exited the right side of my nose, blew out my right cheekbone. What was left of my cheekbone broke and kicked out to the right, vaporized my orbital floor, broke all the bones above my eye, broke the head of my jaw to my chin, and it knocked me out. And the guy saw me fall, so they thought I was dead. So when I came to, and I don't know, we estimate this firefight was 35 to 40 minutes. We don't have all the footage from the entire firefight, but I've seen both the AC-130. They have some of the AC-130 footage, and they also have some of the audio, which I have seen and listened to, which is rather surreal. And then there's the drone footage that DOD has. But we estimate it was 35 to 40 minutes for this firefight. When I don't know how long I was unconscious. Probably 5 to 10 minutes maybe. And I finally, when I came to, I was laying flat on my back, and I recognized that laser beams were traveling over me. I wasn't really thinking clearly at first. And then I, as reality set in, I realized, wow, that's tracer fire. So I literally was laying under this firefight that was occurring above me. So my first thought was, okay, well, don't sit up. There was a lowland fire, and I called out to my team leader at that point, and he was like, Red, holy shit, you're still alive? And I was like, yeah, how long to the medevac? Because I knew I was fucked up. And he was like, 5 minutes.
I'm surprised you're still, with the injuries you took to your face and stuff, that they could understand you. You're still able to talk. You talked about hitting your jaw and everything, you know, the top of your jaw.
Well, it broke my jaw, but no, I was able to talk.
Wow.
I'll come back to this point about blood loss, but I was totally pinned down, so I couldn't get up and move back to where they were. I tried to get my tourniquet on, and this is a lesson learned. I try and tell anybody that's an operator, you know, when you get hit and you lose a lot of blood, you are not as strong. So you really need to train with your tourniquet for your ability to get it right arm, left arm, if you're laying on your stomach, on your back, on your side, whatever it is. Because I had fixed my tourniquet on the bottom of my body armor with three thick rubber bands. Or maybe it was a top. I carry it on the bottom now. But I could not break those rubber bands. They were like the heavy packing rubber bands we use for parachutes. I couldn't break it. I had, you know, I'd lost so much blood right off the bat that I was too weak to break it. So I wasn't able to get my own tourniquet on. So, you know, I caution guys out there, think about that. Think about every situation you may have to be able to get to your tourniquet. So I had to wait. I just had to wait. I realized that, hey, you know, I got to let the guys win the firefight. They can't rush out here and get me, they'll get shot. So I just had to be patient. So finally, my team leader tried to call in a fire mission from the gunship, and the gunship initially said, no, there's no way. You guys are way danger close. I was only 45 feet from the machine gun that had me pinned down. So this is way within danger close parameters, meaning for those that don't understand, when we talk about danger close, or if you've heard that term, we know what both the explosive concussion is from a blast and the fragmentation radius. And in order for friendly forces not to be fragged or hurt by the blast, we need to be outside of both of those things, which is danger close parameters. We know based on munitions, what we're using, obviously a 500 pound JDAM has a much greater danger close parameter than, you know, 40 mic. So we were well within that. And the gunship said, no, you have to fall back. You've got to figure out a way. And my team leader was like, there is no way. You know, there's no place for us to go. I got, you know, two critically wounded, or three critically wounded. And so a little bit more time went by. He called again. They said no. On the third time, he called and said, hey, look, there's not going to be anybody left. We're running out of ammo. And I got guys bleeding out. So at this point, they basically said to my team leader, hey, it's on you. Like, you know, they made him give his, so JTACs in the military have a specific designator, meaning they have officially been through, it stands for Joint Tactical Air Controller. So they've been through the official military DOD training to be able to drop bombs or munitions from aircraft and understand everything about that. Because before we had JTAC training, there were friendly fire incidents where we killed people. So the DOD created the JTAC program, Joint Tactical Air Controller Program. So every JTAC has a special designator. And they made him read off his designator in the middle of this firefight to put the onus on him. Like, hey, you understand what's happening here. We're bringing fire in directly on your position. You're probably going to die. And you have to take responsibility for that. And he did. And then he, the way he coordinated that, he did a great job. And I'll never forget, man, I was laying there and he yelled out incoming, and there is a delay. The aircraft flies at a specific altitude that's fairly high. And when the gun goes off, there's a delay. It takes time for those rounds to travel the thousands and thousands of feet. And I remember it going off and the machine gun still chunking away, and all of a sudden it hit right in front of us and blew up over us, and all of a sudden that machine gun went cold. And that dude started yelling out, Allah, Allah, Akbar. And I remember thinking to myself, stand by, bro, because here he comes. And sure enough, man, next rounds came in right after that. And that guy was out. That machine gun didn't come up again. I think they took out the other machine gun in the Lowland fire. My team leader ran forward and got me and dragged me back to the tire. He got a tourniquet on my arm and they packed my face. So I owe my life to my teammates, my team leader, that gunship. We ended up calling in, I think, at least four fire missions before the medevac came in. When the medevac came in, it landed about 75 yards from us. And my team leader started to drag me, which I felt a lot of pain when I was shot in the arm. But once I was shot in the face, I didn't feel any pain. But once he started dragging me, I felt all the pain. And I was like, stop, let me get up. And I got him to help me get up. I thought my arm had been shot off because I couldn't feel it. I couldn't feel anything. I think I might have been laying on it or something. But when I would reach over, I didn't feel it. It had killed all the nerves. And I told him, and I also took my helmet off in the firefight. You guys don't have video, but that's the round I took through my helmet.
So for everybody that was looking, you've got one of the older style helmets, but it's coming in right above. On the left side.
Yep. Which is why my skull artwork now has that bullet hole in the forehead, which thankfully was not in my forehead. But I took my helmet off and I told my team leader, I said, hey, grab my arm, grab my helmet. I'm going to the helicopter. And I ended up walking those 75 yards to the helicopter. And I will never forget, I forever have this seared into my mind. I remember walking hunched over and literally watching the blood pour out of my face as I walked to that helicopter. And the last, you know, it's interesting what sears in your mind. I got to the helicopter and there's a metal handle on the right side of the 60 right by the door gunner. And like, I can clearly remember grabbing that handle and seeing my gloved hand with blood on it. Like that seared into my memory. And I managed to get on the helicopter. They pushed me up against the opposite side door next to the other door gunner. And then they got our other two guys in the helicopter. They took us to Baghdad. Balad was typically where they want to take head injuries, but we were so critical that Baghdad was closer. And 160th crew flew the rotors off to get us to Baghdad. Because there were three of us, this helicopter was only configured for two. And they couldn't shut the door. And so you've got me, who's been shot multiple times. You've got Maddie, who's been shot three times. You've got our medic, Luke, who almost had his leg severed from the PKM round that hit him below the knee. So we're bleeding all over the place. And what I later met these 160th guys a couple of years later, and they told me that what happened, because the doors couldn't shut, created this mist of blood inside the helicopter. So by the time they landed at Baghdad, like, everybody's coated in blood. And they said it took them weeks to get the blood out from every crack and crevice. It was all in the knobs. And they didn't know if we survived. They literally offloaded us, and they took us.
Had to get back in the fight.
Yeah, and they took.
I was going to say, you bring up a really good thing to a lot of, you mentioned it, but it's the 160th. It's the Special Operations Aviation Regiment. These guys, the Night Stalkers, I mean, just legendary for some of the stuff they've been able to do.
Yeah, those guys were amazing. I worked with them throughout my career, and I owe my life to them that night. I mean, that 160th crew did an amazing job.
And which branch are they, by the way? Which branch are they?
That Air Force. It's U.S. Army. Hey, man, I speak Army.
Yeah,
I support my Army brethren.
Yeah.
So I support my Army brethren right up until the Army-Navy game. And then Navy.
Then it's off for 3 hours. Yeah. That's an interesting. And why is it that they couldn't get the doors closed? Was somebody hanging out or...
Yeah, there wasn't enough room. So you had at least one of our teammates went with us to accompany us to Baghdad. And then you had three wounded guys, myself and the other two guys. And both other guys had leg injuries. So they're trying to lay them out in the helicopter, and they were unable to shut the door because of that. So
What a harrowing story. I'm sitting here with goosebumps. I swear, man, you get into this and I can imagine in my mind, I can picture, I've read this in your book, but then you telling it, you can just picture in your mind how dangerous. I mean, I can't think of a stronger word. And for you guys to come out alive is just, it's God sent, man. I mean, it's a miracle you guys got out of there.
And it's in your face too. You can watch as you're talking. I mean, I watch your eyes and I watch what you're doing, and you see just that. It's almost like I see the images you're seeing. Not really, but I mean, when you talk about reaching up, grabbing, seeing what's out there on the battlefield, looking for your tourniquet, I mean, the visuals are just so powerful from what you're describing there. It's like, and it had to be, you've got that much fire going over you and those people out there. There's no words for it.
Well, I mean, the words are, I mean, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that gunship. And rightfully so, that gunship was awarded the main leadership, the gunner, your targeting officer. They were all awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross for that night, and everybody else on that mission received the an Air Medal for that night. Rightfully so, our guys. I wanted my team leader. I recommended him for a Navy Cross. It got downgraded to a Silver Star. Which I still think he deserves a Navy Cross, which I'm going to go back and try and see if we can do that. And some of one of our guys who got our medic, he got a Silver Star also, but I think our other guys deserve more. And I think my team leader, who I owe my life to, definitely deserves a Navy Cross.
So the gunship, were they firing 40 mics you were talking about? I mean, that had, you talk about accuracy from that distance. I mean, because it's like if they put it right on target, you're gonna get hit. So it's almost like they had to gauge it so that this guy's in the blast radius, and you're like, they moved the X over, as you were saying, they moved the X over enough to where it could take these guys out, but not hit you.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, that night in June, we called fire in on that house. We were only 60 yards away. We were up on the rooftop of the next house we had fallen back to. So, I mean, we were right on the edge of danger close. So to watch that occur and then literally to be laying there and have the rounds hit right in front of you. So I don't know, you know, I don't know why we're still here. Obviously very fortunate.
You know, just, and so we've done a complete circle here, because when we started this, we talked about when you're younger and you hadn't reached your maturity level yet. And I mean this in all sincerity. I don't mean to, for any of this to be funny. Where in the beginning, if you survived that would have been, look what Jason did. But through, you know, the humanity within the military service and some foresight on some officials' parts to send you to Ranger School, which you told us that's where you learned leadership, that's where you grew up at. And now, you know, to hear you tell your story here, and you're giving credit to the people that kept you alive. And it wasn't the gunship. Singularly, it wasn't the helicopter crew that got you out. It wasn't your team leader that, you know, came in and helped you get out. They were shocked that you were still alive. It was a combination of everything. But I guess what I'm trying to say here is to hear you say now they got credit and they deserve credit. And this is what this person did to save me. And all these people saved me were in the beginning would have been, look what Jason did. I went in and kicked the devil's ass and walked away from it. God bless you, brother. It's
Well, on the medical team, I mean, you know, I mean, I owe my life to the amazing medical team and what they did. So, I didn't do a whole lot in that gunfight. I got shot up.
Well, you're smart enough to not raise up.
Yeah, you were smart enough to say, I'm keeping down here. But let's talk a little bit about that too, the recovery, the process of recovery. You're first in Baghdad, right? So what's the process of recovery look like for you from Baghdad? Where do you go? I mean, how long does it take before you're back in the U.S.? You know, kind of give us the idea of what it's like to recover from this.
So I woke in Baghdad, or I came out of the first surgery where they saved my life, and I didn't really think I was going to make it. I in the book I talk about stay awake, stay alive, and I think, you know, I called out to the big man. I think he, you know, between the amazing medical staff, I think a little bit of just willpower, and then obviously I think he had the ultimate say in that. So when I came to, I'll be honest, I was so euphoric that I was still alive. Like, that was amazing. My commanding officer and command master chief were there in Baghdad. And I asked them, well, the first thing I remember is I tried to ask him a question. I couldn't. I tried to say something. And the nurse like, hey, you're trached. You're not going to be able to talk. You're wired shut and you're trached. So I said, okay, give me a piece of paper. And I asked three questions. I said, are my guys okay? Has my wife been notified? And, you know, levity plays such a big deal, you guys know. And I said, do I still look pretty?
And how did they answer?
So my
CEO said, no.
Yeah, the guys are good. They're both out of surgery and they're fine. They said, yes, I spoke to your wife myself. I told her you're the luckiest guy I know. And he said, and no, you definitely do not. This will probably be an improvement. So,
was your medic able to keep his leg?
Yeah. Yeah. He had what's called drop foot. So he was never able to repair that, but he ended up wearing a brace and he did a couple more deployments before he got out of the military. And now he's in the business world doing great. So, but from Baghdad, they moved me to Balad, and I had more surgeries in Balad and I was in and out of consciousness during these times. And then they flew me to Landstuhl. I had a couple more surgeries in Landstuhl. And then they flew me home on an ICU medevac flight. And what's amazing is that process was 96 hours. So I was wounded early American time. It would have been, I think we figured out Wednesday night, Iraq time. It was early Thursday morning. Coincidentally, my wife and I did the math. She was actually at a post-deployment meeting for the spouses at the time I was getting all shot up. And they were talking about this was a really hard deployment. And they were talking about post-traumatic stress. And she was like, I don't need to know about that. You know, Jay's going to be fine. And literally right during that conversation, I was getting shot up. But I was home to Bethesda by Sunday night. So a 96-hour turnaround from – so what an amazing medical system that we have created. And a lot of that's a big testament to Robert Gates, the way he laid out the medevac system both in Iraq and Afghanistan to be able to get us out, and then this flow, because obviously they want to get us home as quickly as they can.
So four surgeries in 96 hours?
Yeah, at least.
Wow. Man, and then the surgeries, and then in between that, moving you from, like you said, Baghdad to Balad, Balad to Germany, right?
Correct.
And then Germany back here. You know, I tell you what, there's always a lot of things being said, but the one thing I was always impressed with the military, and this goes back, my dad was World War II and a Vietnam vet, and I read a lot, I mean, of history. I just go back and think about all the planning that went into stuff like World War II, the things they had to think of, you know, and all the lessons learned, the logistics lessons and everything, and it's like you move forward, and it's forward deploy, and it's like, now when you're thinking about this, it's like, I'll tell you what, I tell you who has career. Some of the people who do logistics in the Army, they come out and they work for FedEx or UPS. They just like crush it. It's like, get a packet from here to there. No problem. I once brought a guy back from Baghdad, four operations, three cities, 96 hours, you know?
Yep. And with all the ICU equipment I needed, and I wasn't the only one. That plane was packed. There was probably at least 15 of us who were in ICU beds, and then I don't know, 30 or 40 who were ambulatory on that plane on a C-141 out of Landstuhl.
Well, with the damage to your eye and your orbital socket, did you keep the sight in your right eye?
I did. It got damaged. Amazingly, though, the optic nerve was not damaged, and the doctors were flabbergasted by that. What ended up happening, they had to totally rebuild. My orbital floor was gone, vaporized. The bullet, when it hit me and it traveled, it went, it came in right in front of my ear, and it basically took off most of my nose. It traveled right under my eye. The eye fell into this newfound hole. So they, when they put it back, they put a temporary orbital floor of titanium. Later, they tried to reconstruct that, and then that had issues. Ultimately, they ended up peeling off a part of my skull, a layer of my skull, and that became my new orbital floor. But the eye wouldn't align. So it took, I don't know, at least a year and a great surgeon at Johns Hopkins who was able to realign my eyes back. And I still have some issues with double vision. If I'm looking on a straight plane, I'm good. If I glance to the right or the left, I get, or even up, I get double vision. But, you know, so what? Turn your head.
So
better not being able to see.
Yeah. Well, in fact, it reminds me, one of his friends, Steve's friends, a guy named Joe Pierisanti, DEA, he was in one of the FAST teams, is over in Afghanistan. He took a round through the head, temple, like basically temple to temple. They thought he was dead, but he got up and he got on there. He's blind now. I mean, he's tried to recover, but it, like you say, it's just amazing what they can do. But mm-hmm. to that point, you're in the recovery. We want to talk about something that has become very famous, and that's the sign. When did you get the sign about the sign? And did you listen to Ace of Base about I Saw the Sign? You know, or how did this come about?
So the sign, I did listen to a lot of music. That was one of the things. I am a huge fan of music. I don't play any instruments, but I love music. And so it is funny that you say that, because that was one of the very first things I asked for. As a matter of fact, when I was in Balad, I made them go find my iPhone and speakers, and the ICU did not like us that I was blaring Tool in the ICU. They tried to shut it down, and you know, my teammates chased them away. But when I got to the hospital in Bethesda, I had the same thing set up, and we listened to everything. So, and the nurse always liked it. They always liked coming to my room because we had good music. So, but the sign came about probably about a week after I'd been back. I mean, I don't know the exact timeline, what day, but, and I will admit, and I talk to a lot of people about this, that, you know, I speak on getting off the X and the overcome mindset, and time is relative. You know, I'd love to tell you that I got to the hospital and was like, man, I'm going to crush this. It took a few days. I mean, there was a lot of, holy shit, where do I go from here? You know, I was so weak from the blood loss, I couldn't even get out of bed. I had the nurses help me use the bathroom. They were talking about amputating my arm. I had no use in my left hand. They told me from the nerve damage. So I ended up taking two rounds. I took a round right here in the lower bicep, and I took a round on the inside of my forearm, and they exited the backside of my arm, which just destroyed my elbow. And the doctor said, you know, there's no way we can repair this. You know, they were thinking about amputating my arm above the elbow. And the only thing that stopped it is the head orthopedic surgeon in Bethesda happened to be a former SEAL. And he said, I'm gonna figure out how to save your arm. So I owe my arm to him, to Dan Balaik. So shout out to you, Dan. But this is all the information they're inundating me with, all this negative information. You know, it's going to take years to put you back together. And I was struggling with all of that. And I don't know, at some point, probably a week later, I had some people that came into the room, and they were just talking about what a shame, what a pity, you know, it's so sad, the military hospital. And they are. Military hospitals during time of war are a really hard place to be. You know, you got young, super banged up individuals who are burned and shot and broken and missing limbs and traumatic brain injuries. And these individuals were basically overwhelmed by that, and we're talking about that. And they were off to themselves in my room having this conversation, but I overheard it. And when they left, I remember thinking to myself, like, man, is that me? Like, is that truly who I am now? Am I this broken veteran that's never going to be successful again? Am I going to be like this, I don't know, this drunk or drug addict that, you know, homeless and is never successful, you know, like Lieutenant Dan and Forrest Gump, you know, hookers and booze, Lieutenant Dan. And,
I'm sorry. One of my favorite characters. I'm sorry. I do that to my wife all the time. She'll be saying, I gave her my Lieutenant Dan wave, you know, from Force. Lieutenant Dan, Lieutenant Dan. You know, what a great, that, Gary Sinise, though, you mentioned, you know, what a great guy and what a great movie.
He is. I'm an ambassador for his foundation now. Gary is absolutely amazing. Probably one of the more genuine people you will meet.
With the Lieutenant Dan band. What a, that's an awesome thing.
So, yeah, I just, you know, it's funny. People will, I call it, you know, they'll put you in the victim box. And I remember thinking to myself, wait a minute, like, you just walked the hardest path you've ever walked. A lot of people think that my injuries were the hardest thing that I've ever been through. But really, my leadership failure and building myself back up was the hardest thing I've ever been through. And I had just finished this journey. And I was like, dude, you've been through this before. Like, this situation right now is no different. You just need to follow the same principles and lead and choose to drive forward. And I told my wife when she came back in the room, I said, hey, from this point forward, I will not feel sorry for myself. There's no pity allowed in this room. And I wrote out the sign straight there. It was a straight stream of consciousness. And the sign said, attention to all who enter here. If you're coming in this room with sadness or sorrow, go elsewhere. The wounds I received, I got a job that I love, doing it for people that I love, defending the freedom of a country that I deeply love. I will make a full recovery. What is full? That's the absolute utmost physically. I have the ability to recover. And I'm going to push that about 20% further through sheer mental tenacity. This room you're about to enter is a room of fun, optimism, and intense rapid regrowth. If you're not prepared for that, go elsewhere. And, you know, we signed it. The original sign was on a regular piece of paper. But several days later, somebody missed it. So I told my wife, I said, hey, I need something bigger and brighter to put this on. And she went down to the exchange and found that big orange piece of paper and or poster board. And we transcribed it word for word onto that. And from there, it took on a life of its own. It was on all the national media. People started blogging about it. It earned me an invitation to the White House to meet President Bush. To date, it's been who signed it, and I didn't keep it. It now hangs in the Wounded Ward at Walter Reed. It's been written about in books, you know, documentaries. So it is pretty amazing. I've had so many people from across the country who have put it on their hospital door with cancer, or they've been in an accident, or their kid's been in an accident. So it's pretty amazing the impact of that sign now.
Well, the guy we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast was T.J. Webb, police officer that used your sign to motivate himself, the Connecticut police officer. And I think you've since met him, but you've affected people that, you know, positively that you had no clue. You were just giving your personal opinion there, but it's had so much positive effect on so many people.
I like the way you signed it, though. It says from the management, and then there's the trident, just bam.
And so the interesting thing is, I didn't do that. A teammate of mine who had come to the room took his trident off and tacked it into the door. And I got to tell you, it was an amazing moment for me because here's a guy who had failed and at one point was told, you don't measure up and we're going to take your trident, to come full circle. And have the team, obviously my teammate said, you know what, dude, you set the example. And, you know, I'm not perfect. I'm not the greatest SEAL out there. You'll never, ever hear me say that. I got a lot of teammates who are no longer here who are far better than me. But that was a huge moment for me to come full circle. And I don't even remember who did it. I don't even remember what teammate it was, but I appreciate them. And it was their trident they tacked into the door.
Man, when your peers accept you, you know you've made it.
Well, I love it. That was the ultimate exclamation point. It's like, fuck yeah. Bam.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Look, man, we could go on for a long time. And the other thing, too, is we've done this in two parts because you had some commitments. So we got to honor your commitments. You got something coming up here. But, you know, just from us, people can't see this me saluting you. And we salute you not only for you, but for everybody who's gone before you, those who we will not have a drink with tonight, but we will have a drink in their honor. And I mean, this stuff just gets to me because you look at the people who have sacrificed so much, and the people who sacrificed so much always ask for so little in return. They're not the ones out there saying, gimme, gimme, gimme. They ask for very little. But the thing we do owe you is a debt that can never be repaid. So,
And before we go, Jason, I just want to recognize Erica, your wife, for sticking by your side, because it doesn't always happen. You know, Joe Pierisanti, who we was just talking about, was shot through the head. His wife couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
She left him. So, Erica, and hats off to you, lady.
Go ahead. Such a common thing. A lot of people don't, I mean, the divorce rate in special operations is through the roof. The divorce rate in the Wounded Warrior community is through the roof. And man, a lot of people don't realize in the Trident, I tell Erica our whole story because I wanted people to see what an amazing person she is. And we are still together, strong, have amazing kids. We've run a multiple businesses together. We still do it. So it's become such a topic of conversation. I'm excited. This will be the first podcast I announce this, but we are signing a deal with HarperCollins for a relationship book we will release in January 24.
We are making news, folks, exclusive to Game of Crime.
There you go.
Yeah,
there you go.
That's right. So for any of you out there who are like, man, how did you do it? We're not special. It's just, you know, I think we approached our marriage like a mission. And Erica had a very kind of military Spartan life mindset. And we've applied that. And, you know, we've been able to navigate all these hard roads and problems.
Well, I see the sign. The sign is a kind of a metaphor for the marriage, right? If you're going to enter into this marriage, if you're going to come here, I mean,
commit.
Yep.
Yeah.
Commit. Yeah, it is, and we both said that at the very beginning. We both had come from families that were divorced, and when we went into this marriage, we said never, death. That's it,
folks. You got to check out jasonredmond.com. You'll see what all he's up to now. There's so much, and we're getting into his time here. We know he's got other commitments, but Erica, proud of you. Probably should have mentioned you at the beginning because he just kind of followed in your shadows. The way I look at it, you know. I think we all married up, so.
Oh, yeah. And let's finish up with your book. So, folks, you got to go there. We'll put it on our book page, and we'll put a link to his, The Trident, The Forging and Reforging of a Navy SEAL Leader. Also, Overcome, which is, you've got books that are required reading now. I believe the Trident is required reading.
For leadership. Navy, Marine Corps, and the Coast Guard put both books in different areas.
Is the Marine version come with crayons and pictures they can color in?
No, it's a pop-up book.
There you see. You're thinking of these guys. Thank you so much.
They didn't even give them to the Army, right? Because there's not enough pictures in either one of the books.
Right, yeah. And the Marines, you know, love you guys. You know, I'll eat a crayon any day with you fellas.
Anyway. Well, hey, look, pal, let's bring this to a close. But first of all, thank you so much for being generous with your time. And seriously, this is us saluting you. Thank you for your recovery. But biggest thing, thanks for the lessons. You're here for a reason. It was not your day to die, brother. And the reason why is because you're here to teach the next generation of leaders what it's really like to lead. So this is us saluting you. You stay safe, Murph.
Yeah, I got to say a couple words here. Once you set the freaking standard, brother, for other people to follow. That, as we all know, that doesn't happen in all the occupations, especially the danger occupations. So, thank you for the leadership lessons that you're providing now, for being so humble and transparent about your story. People don't like to tell bad things about themselves, but you've laid everything out on the line, which that's what makes this such a good book to read. I highly recommend The Trident. I read it. It only took me about 3 years to read it, but I'm kind of a slow reader. But he did include some pictures. No, it's one of those books you can't put down, seriously. I mean, it's a big-ass book. But, I mean, you can read it in just a couple of days because it is that good. So thank you for your service to our country. God bless you. God bless Erica, your children. If there's anything that Morgan and I or Game of Crimes can ever do for you, brother, we're there for you.
Well, let's come back when this new relationship book and we can talk about, because, man, God knows in law enforcement, fire, and the military, we all struggle with relationships.
We do.
You will be back.
Yeah. Okay. Don't go anywhere. Everybody else, stay tuned for the debrief. And my last final words, go Army, beat Navy.
Oh, God.
Well, you know, just the sign, the whole thing about the sign, the way he tied it in, the way TJ Webb talked about it, which really gave us a lot to talk about with him. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, here's the thing. This is a guy who humbled himself. He finally realized that, hey, look.
It's not all about me.
in the teams, as they call it, in the teams, your reputation precedes you. And he was getting a reputation for being a hot dog, you know, John Wayne-ing it, doing it all by himself. And part of his punishment, growth opportunity, was being sent to Ranger School, where Ranger School taught you about leadership. So, I mean, what, I mean, just, and the fact he spent this time with us, carved out time. Actually, folks, what I should have told you beforehand, we had some technical difficulties. Some of the audio kind of got garbled. We had to fix it. It was nothing. Don't know what happened, but he graciously came back a second day so we could finish up and just gave his time. And just, by the way, both you and him gave me the bird, so I feel honored to be double flipped.
We both gave you doubles.
You gave me doubles.
That's right.
The sign on the door. I got a sign for you too. He calls it the sign on the door. I got a sign for you too.
I tell you what, and that sign, I'm sure you heard about it, or if you just heard about it on the podcast, go look at his website. It's jasonredmond.com and look at the sign. Because when you mentioned it just now, I got goosebumps all over again.
And it's free to download, Murph. That's your word, free. It's free to download.
Yeah, baby.
Free.
Nothing wrong with free. And the relationship with TJ Webb is just phenomenal. We brought that up to him, and he remembered TJ, and I know it meant so much to TJ as well. So, and I'm sure TJ's listening. So thank you, brother. And thank both you guys for surviving, you know, for sacrificing yourselves for our country, for our safety, for our freedom, whether it's in the international or the domestic arenas. A true honor to have a true American hero on here. Go check out his books. You're going to love The Titan. When I started reading it, I couldn't put it down.
The Trident. You said The Titan. The Trident. The Titan is a robot. The Trident.
But you know what I meant. The Trident.
And by the way, his books are required reading now at the academies and in some of the military colleges, war colleges. So that's what kind of an impact it had.
And you know what? He's out on the speaking circuit. He's a motivational speaker. So check out his website if you're in a corporate event or if your company is looking for speakers. Highly recommend Jason Redmond.
And I know what we got out of him for our time. You guys will definitely get that out of it. So anyway, guys, we hope you enjoyed that. Head on over to Apple Podcast or head on over to Spotify and Apple. Hit those 5 stars. It really helps us a lot. Especially tell us what you thought about Jason, his story. His struggles, because I think a lot of you can identify with that. Also, head on over to GameOfCrimesPodcast.com for more information about the show and the links to his books. You can find him anywhere, including on our site. Follow us on that thing they call social media at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Also, Game of Crimes fans, just type that into your search bar in Facebook. Get with Sandy Salvato, the Velvet Glove, the Iron Maiden with the Velvet Glove, the Mafia Queen. Answer a couple questions, get in there. We have a lot of more fun discussions behind the scenes there. Also, head on over to Patreon, patreon.com/Game of Crimes. Like I said, you can't make this shit up. This episode was funny. We're going to do the Long Island serial killer for our case of the month. Mm-hmm. And we got to think, too, about what we want to do for our narcometer review. That's coming up as well, too, as 911, what's your emergency? We got a lot of good things coming up. So head on over there. Right, Murph? Right.
Absolutely. Patreon's the place you got to be. We get a little bit more personal, I guess. We stay apolitical here on the podcast. But on Patreon, you ask for opinions, we give them to you.
Well, and they did. On the Q&A, we had a lot of good questions, which allowed us to discuss some political things about our beliefs, but we don't foist those on people. Our idea is that, look, we simply tell the stories. You guys are smart enough to do your own research and come to your own conclusions. But that being said, with the speaking of bringing things to a conclusion, here is the conclusion of this conclusion, which concludes this episode, Murph. So how do we do that? We say by thank you guys for playing. Once again, the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.